And today is the full moon day of April, and also this year, this day happens to coincide with Good Friday and the Easter period. So it's a good opportunity to reflect upon these religious conventions of the Buddhist tradition and Christian tradition. It's, say, the forms of religion established in this country. Alan Paul Sumato is very keen, very active in exploring and reflecting upon different religious symbols and using these in his teachings and also for his own illumination over many, many years. And I feel this is a very useful process and something to encourage, and to, particularly with such a multicultural group that we have gathered here at Amravati. Just within the resident community, we have something like 20 or maybe 24, 25 different nationalities of people living here. So it's a we have many different cultural roots, many different mythologies, and background stories that we are conditioned by. So it's, it can be useful to look at the influences that are in the world around us and influence us from our past, as well as the influences from the Buddhist tradition that we, say, are practicing within at this time and in this place. The word Easter, if you look it up in the Oxford English Dictionary, comes from the name of a Northumbrian goddess of the dawn, Eostra, probably deriving from the Sanskrit Ustra, also was a dawn goddess, Ushra, the goddess of the dawn in the Indian tradition. There are many, many, say, different religious traditions or symbols around this period of time, the spring period of the Northern Hemisphere, after the winter time, life coming back into the world, and then the sun rising in the east, the reappearance of the sun and the waking up of the world in the morning, being also then connected with the reawakening of life from the ground, the buds appearing on the trees, the flowers springing up, the grass starting to grow, animals starting to pair off and mate and produce offspring. It's also interesting in the Buddhist tradition, we always have, traditionally you always have a Buddha image facing towards the east. That's why the temple is oriented exactly as it is on the eastern axis, and when it's the equinox, the spring equinox, then the sun rises right in the east, and then shines directly into the temple. That's not by accident. And also within the Buddhist tradition, the Sakyan people, the Buddha's own tribe, consider themselves to be descended from the ancient sun god Okaka. This mentioned in the suttas, and that one of the titles, one of the epithets of the Buddha was the Aditya Bandhu, or kinsman of the sun, one who's a descendant of the sun, not S-O-N, but S-U-N, the sun god. The Aditya is the solar deity, the solar god. So the symbol of Easter, the dawn, and what you have in the Christian tradition is this, and the symbol of resurrection. Easter is the today. Good Friday is the by Christian tradition the day when Jesus got crucified and then was dead in the death state for 3 days, and then was resurrected, came back to life again, according to the Christian mythology. But again, it's that story that we have from the Christian Bible, the New Testament, isn't by any means unique. And actually, in that same region, in the Mediterranean, long before Jesus was born, in the some of the areas of the Greek world, they had a festival this time of the year, spring equinox, when the day and the night are equal lengths, where, if I'm remembering the story correctly, there were in certain regions, the festival for the spring consisted of the people from the town going out and selecting a young tree, a pine tree, and then cutting it down and dressing it up with garlands and flowers and ribbons and carrying it into the town with great ceremony, and everyone celebrating and cheering and rejoicing, just like Jesus coming into Jerusalem on the donkey. And then having been carried into the town, then the tree is ritually slaughtered, stabbed and killed, and then put into the ground. And then 3 days as if it had died and been killed. And then 3 days later, the tree symbolically comes back to life, is brought out of the tomb, and then is, say, dressed up again in all its finery, as if it's arisen from the dead. So that particular tradition existed several hundred years before Jesus was born, with the sort of almost identical symbols of being carried into the town with great ceremony and rejoicing, and then being blamed and killed, ritually slaughtered, and then coming back to life 3 days later. So you might find this completely uninteresting and irrelevant to Buddha Dhamma, but I feel it's important to consider the spiritual traditions that are around us and that inform our lives, that we might have grown up with or that we've come across, and to see that they're not just isolated stories, or they're not just a single declaration of truth, but rather they're themes, they're ideas, stories that can be useful symbols for us. The story of Jesus's crucifixion, Lumpo Sameta, if you listen to his Dhamma teachings or read his books, last year we spent a lot of time gathering together a large volume, five large volumes of his teachings, so putting together all of the published books and many talks and interviews and otherwise unpublished old material, about 600,000 words worth of material. And it was very striking how often he talked about the Christian story. And he grew up in a very observant Anglican family, Church of England Christianity of North America. It was called the Episcopalian Church. And so the Christian symbolism was very strong in Lumpo Sameta's perceptions and memory, and it had a big influence on him when he was growing up. He even thought of becoming a Christian priest at one point. So that appears, these stories appear quite frequently in his Dhamma teachings, and particularly the crucifixion, and that the experience of being nailed to the cross, and betrayed, humiliated, and then nailed, pinned down to the cross, just to die in pain. And often Lumpur would reflect upon that as how when we are attached to the experiences of our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, our moods, and how we are, say, victimized or hurt or burdened by life, then it's it can be seen as being similar to that, sort of pinned down and sort of nailed to the world, nailed to the way that things are experienced. But then the way that Lumpur would talk about it is that the way that Jesus transcends that is through self-surrender, that sense of complete, say, forgiveness and relinquishment. surrender, or what's called pranidhana, the kind of letting go of self-concern, to be giving that up in a profound way. Yeah, I understand Christian people might see it in a totally different way, and if there are committed Christians here in the group this evening, or listening to this as a recording in the future, I'm not trying to demolish your faith or to insult Jesus as a spiritual teacher or an embodiment of wholesome qualities, but just speaking about these themes in the same way that I would reflect myself, or that my own teachers have done. So that the symbol of crucifixion then is, according to this way of thinking, it's a way of, in a sense, what happens is that in the crucifixion and the resurrection, it's the Christian version of the Buddha's enlightenment. It's the conquest of death, and it starts off with this being nailed to the cross of, I don't like it, it's not fair, I don't want this, I've had enough, I'm out of here. How can you treat me that way? This is unfair. What have I done to deserve this? I don't like this, I've had enough. I want more and I can't have it. We've got to do something about this. That pain in the heart of association with the disliked, separation from the like, not getting what we want. And how we handle that, if we follow the example of the Buddha's conquest of Mara, it's through that quality of awareness. And as just as Mara tempts the Buddha with all kinds of threats difficulties of dealing with the army of attacking demons, or the forces of attraction, forces of responsibility, then the Buddha meets all of those with wisdom and conquers those threats with waking up. That's how the Buddha conquers death, is through the realization of the deathless. So you have in the crucifixion and the resurrection the sort of Christian version of conquering death. And obviously there's a whole different variety of elements. And when I've talked about this in Christian circles, then a certain kind of tightening. I once gave a Dhamma talk on this kind of theme in Old St. Mary's Cathedral, Catholic Cathedral in San Francisco, which some of the group enjoyed it. I think some of the church elders were a little bit tight-lipped about these sort of reflections. But I feel it's important to be ready to look at your own traditions, whether you think of yourself as a Buddhist or a Christian or a spiritual person who's not religious, who has no beliefs, or whether you're a Muslim or a communist or an anarcho-syndicalist or whatever you like to call yourself. I'm a nothing, that's what I am. I'm nothing, Whatever you conceive yourself to be, it's important to take a step back and consider to the best degree that you can, what are these structures and forms that I'm using to frame my experience of living, and how do they work? Do they support the aspiration to freedom, to living in a wholesome and harmonious way? So Ajahn Buddhadasa, in the very very similar spirit to Lumpur Cha, Lumpur Sumedho, was very flexible in his approach towards spirituality. He at Suan Mok Monastery, there's this wonderful building. It's shaped like a huge boat, and it's called the Spiritual Theatre. And it has like a massive emporium, a kind of big sort of collection of all sorts of different symbols. It's got lots of European folk tales and fairy tales painted on the walls, with copying the pictures out of old European children's books and books of mythology and fairy stories. It's got Christian symbols and the Hindu gods and Stories from the Quran and the Jewish and Old Testament and everything. It's all in there, arrayed around in this the spiritual theater. For the similar purpose, helping people to consider their life through the lens or the perspective of different spiritual forms. He was once invited to give a whole series of talks at a Christian seminary. They're gathered together in a book of his called Buddhism and Christianity. And one of the points that Ajahn Buddhadasa made about the crucifixion, he says, it's a really excellent spiritual symbol, especially in the English language, because you can look at the crucifix as the word I deleted. That's an easy one to take home. It's just the word I crossed out. So that's what this is a symbol of. It's about self relinquishment, letting go of self-view, self-centered thinking. It's to do with that abandonment of sakkaya ditti, the breaking through of self-view and self-concerned perspective on life. There's a similar story that we have, an example that the Buddha gave in the suttas in the middle length discourses. Sutta number 22 is called the simile of the saw. The Kakachupama Sutta, and this is where he gives the example of the establishment of the heart in loving kindness and how hatred or negativity is totally contrary to his teaching. And so he in giving this example, he says, if you were kidnapped by a group of bandits and they were cutting your body into pieces with a two-handled saw, so that you're strapped down and you've got two of the bandits on a two-person saw, one at each end, and they're sawing your arms and legs off. He said, even if you're literally in the same way as Jesus being crucified, you're strapped down and being humiliated and just physically destroyed. He said, even if the bandits are cutting your arms and legs off, he said, one who gave rise to a feeling of aversion in relation to the people who were causing that harm, they would not be following my teaching. So I understand whenever I talk about this or use this quotation, I feel it's important to acknowledge that the Buddha is setting the bar very, very high. It's like you're beginning the high jump, but with the bar at a couple of meters for starters. It's a high standard. But the Buddha was a genius at creating these mental images that really get our attention, but also very accurately represent his spiritual principles that he's pointing to. So even in a situation like that, where you'd feel you have every justifiable reason to be a bit annoyed, even just a little bit peeved at the people, cutting your arms and legs off. That it's bad enough that you were kidnapped and you're being held prisoner, but you'd think it's not unreasonable to have a little bit of aversion to the people who are abusing you so awfully. But the point being is that even in a situation like that, which is totally heinous and illegal and cruel, even then, if you dwell in aversion, you put your mind towards aversion and hatred, then that is automatically and inherently going against the Dhamma. It's going against the teaching. At that moment, the heart is filled with hatred and blame and negativity towards those other beings. And he said, rather than dwelling in hatred or giving rise to a thought of hatred, aversion towards those who are harming you, rather you should think, and this is where our chant on the Brahma Viharas that we do, where it comes from. I will abide pervading one quarter with a heart imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself, I will abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a heart imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, free from hatred and ill will. And directing that attitude towards the people who are sawing your arms and legs off. So again, I fully acknowledge that's a bit of a high standard to expect. And you think you might be abiding in hatred when you're doing the washing up and someone steals your sponge. Like, you know, he took my sponge. How dare he? You know, and that something as innocent or as simple as someone moves your sandals or someone takes your sponge when you're in the middle of the washing up, or and you can abide in ill will for several hours. It's a different end of the scale when your arms and legs are being cut off, and yet you still think may those beings be free from all suffering, pervading one quarter with a heart imbued with loving kindness, starting with those people. Then, as the Buddha said in the Sutta, starting with those very ones who are harming you, are cruel to you, and so destructive. And so starting with them and radiating out to the entire world. And so and what this is talking about is that when we change the attitude, when we adopt a different attitude, which is within our power. I mean, the Buddha wouldn't give this example. He wouldn't talk about this if this was not within our ability, our power as human beings. Then we go from living in hell to living in heaven. You know, the hell is, how dare you, this is unfair, what are you doing to me, I hate you. And that misery of aversion and self-pity and fear and resentment. Obviously at one end of the scale, people who really are harming you and are treating you badly, but even if it's a simple thing, like just like somebody didn't smile at you today. Somebody took your sponge at the washing up, or somebody they didn't volunteer for the washing up, but you did, and you can still carry them around and radiate aversion over their entire world for hours and hours, days. You can turn it into a whole vendetta of negativity. So that's hell, is resentment, aversion, self-cherishing, self-centered thinking. But heaven, you know, the Brahma-viharas, the sublime abidings, the divine abodes, the divine attitudes. Brahma meaning divine or holy, sacred, heavenly. Vihara, dwelling place. That is literally heaven, is established within the attitude that we nurture, the attitude that is brought into being. And the Buddha deliberately uses an extreme example to help us wake up to the fact that even in a situation like that, it is possible, and our hell can be transformed into heaven simply through the attitude that we bring into being. So in the teachings, then this transformation, then the establishment of the heart in loving kindness and compassion, metta karuna, mudita upeka, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity or serenity. This is one aspect of approaching it, but when it's taken to a more profound level, then it's the realization of what we call the breakthrough to stream entry, the breakthrough to the Dhamma, to seeing the Dhamma itself, seeing the the fundamental reality of things itself. So in that, then the very first obstacle to the breakthrough, the first barrier to breaking through, truly seeing the Dhamma, knowing the Dhamma, being the Dhamma, is self-view, sakkaya ditti. And when we talk about self-view, it's a Buddhist jargon term. And what it means is that belief, I am the body, I am the personality, this is who and what I am. The story of my birthday, the school that I went to, the family I was born into, my sisters, my brothers, my parents, my nationality, my gender, my language, my personality, my problems, my achievements, to take all of those and to say, I am this, this is me, this is what I am, this is my true self. That is what we mean by sakkaya ditti, self-view, is just that much. I am the body, I'm a male, I'm a female, I'm old, I'm young, I'm fat, I'm thin, I'm healthy, I'm unhealthy. I am the body. That's sakkaya ditti, the view of the true body, the real body. Sa, true, kaya, body, ditti, view, the real body view. I am this person, I am this personality, these stories and absolute truth. That is what the obstacle is, that not that we have, that there is a body, or that there is a personality, or a collection of stories that come from our life and our family and our birth situation and our upbringing, education and so on, but the taking of those to be an absolute truth, like to say today is Good Friday. It's a convention. It's just a human agreement. Say today is the full moon day. Yeah, well, that's the moon is doing what it does, but this is the full moon day according to the Thai calendar. Is it exactly the full moon day according to the European calendar? I'm not sure. I didn't check, but our moon days go according to the Thai calculated moon days rather than the astronomical moon days as they are found in Britain. So our full moon might not be the same as the British national full moon, or what the moon's actually doing in the sky. It's just a convention. Or when we look at the quality of stream entry, the breakthrough into the seeing and knowing the Dhamma, being Dhamma, then it's breaking that illusion, breaking that that perspective, to see that calling ourselves English or American, old or young, female or male, these are just conventional designations. These are just human agreements. Some of them have a bit more weight than others. Our age or our gender or our nationality, we've got documents and biology to back it up. But when we look closely, we see all of those are just kind of approximations, or there are a kind of working reality, a convenient fiction is a phrase I like to use. So sakkaya ditti, a self-view, is the first of the fetters or the obstacles to that quality of realization. And the second is silapatta paramasa, which means attachment or identification with rules and conventions, rituals and observances. So in a way, the sakkaya ditti is referring to identification with internal qualities, you know, the mind and the body, personality. And the second one, silapatta paramasa, is to do with attachment to external structures, the forms of society, what day of the week it is, what the currency is, what the social agreements about what you have as being polite, what's not polite, your customs about which side of the road that you drive on, and what you call beautiful, these change over time. What was considered beautiful 50 years ago is laughable now. And what's considered beautiful now will be weird or strange or laughable in 50 years' time, or 5 years' time. If you look back over history and look at different cultures, it's amazing the variety of different things that were considered normal and beautiful. If somebody showed up at Amravati, if a man came to Amravati with a white wig with a ponytail and a bow and a coat down to his knees with gold brocade around the edges, you'd know that he'd just come off a movie set or was doing some kind of costume thing. But that was, for a certain period of time in the middle of the 18th century, if you were in European countries, you had to go out with a wig. It's only the sort of poor farmers and the artisans who couldn't afford such things that would have to go wigless. Even religious people, even ministers would have to be expected to go around with a white wig on, and white hair was considered de rigueur. It's like a normal and beautiful thing. You had to have a white wig. You couldn't have a black wig or red. Forget it. You had to have a. And then the wigs got really, really complicated and grandiose. And people would have all kinds of illnesses from having wigs on their head all the time. They get maggots breeding in there, or have mice nesting in under their wigs, and have all kinds of interesting skin problems from the nest of mice living on their head. We don't have that problem nowadays. But in the mid 18th century, it was totally normal to wear a wig. That was just what everybody did. Everybody. So the mind that can see the attachment to internal qualities and realize, oh, this is just a convenient fiction. I call myself Ajahn Amaro. My sisters don't call me Ajahn Amaro because I'm not. To them, I'm not. I'm their little brother. But that's the convention of the Theravada monastic community. So that's what I'm known as, Ajahn Amaro. Before Ajahn Pamakara came up with the name, I wasn't Amaro. And then he went through the list of names that go with a Sunday and came up with, oh, that's a good name for him. Nice and short. So that's how I got my name, because Ajahn Pamakara chose it. So if there's a recognition that these internal qualities are just convenient fictions, then Sakkaya Ditti can be seen through. If we see these external forms, the structures and patterns are outside us, are just human agreements, then similarly there can be the breakthrough of attachment, identification with conventions and rituals. It's just like this evening. So if a fire alarm goes off and it's a Friday evening and there's a retreat on, you know that's not a fire. You know, that's the fire alarm test. At least I do. Maybe some of you who are not so familiar with the place go, oh, fire alarm. And so you'd think, maybe there's a fire. Well, there is a fire. But if you know, that's the fire alarm test, that's standard procedure for the beginning of every retreat. So it's not a fire alarm. It's just a noise that they set off to inform the retreatants, this is what the fire alarm sounds like, and this is what you do when it happens. So to be able to look at those agreements and to know them as such, then that's how there is the breakthrough to seeing Silapata Paramasa, identification with rituals and observances, and seeing them as just social conventions. And the tool that is used for that seeing through, that in a way the third fetter, which is vichikicca, which means doubt, and the breaking through doubt is particularly it means doubt about what is the path and what is not the path. And so in a way, one way of looking at it is that the third fetter, the third of those sanyojana, or those obstacles to stream entry, it's talking about the very method whereby you break through the first two, so that seeing the what the path is and how to work with the mind is the way that the first two fetters, the first two obstacles are broken through. So that seeing clearly what is the path, essentially you can summarize that as, well, what needs to be recognized as the path is seeing anicca, seeing the quality of uncertainty, transiency, impermanence, to develop the anicca sanya. That's why many times in the discourses, when someone realizes stream entry, their insight is described as and then they saw, they understood, yankinchi samudaya dhammang sabantang nirodha dhammanti, whatever is subject to arising is subject to ceasing. That's the essential insight. That's the recognized, that's what you need to know. That's the one important fact about all things, whether it's a mental thing or a physical thing, internal or external, whatever it is, it's anicca. Whatever is subject to arising is subject to cessation. And the application of that insight is the path. That's the thing that makes a difference. That's the point of view that makes a difference. At least that's how I would find it's most helpful to characterize it. And so that the third fetter is, in a way, recognizing beyond doubt, to know for sure that this is what the path is. The more that quality of emptiness and uncertainty, impermanence can be seen, then the more the heart can be fully in tune with reality. Because, of course, some things are easy to see as impermanent. A word begins and ends. It's impermanent. A feeling, a sensation in your legs begins and ends. The breath arises and ceases. There's an inhalation and an exhalation. Some things are very easy to see as being transient and changing. Other things are not so difficult. Are not so easy to see. They're much more difficult to discern as being impermanent. We don't even notice that they're there. Attitudes that we have, opinions that we believe in, assumptions about life and people. We don't even know that it's there. So we can't even recognize its presence. So therefore, don't even consider that attitude or that opinion is something that is impermanent and empty of any true substance. We take it to be real. So the more that insight, that way of seeing, can be thoroughly and deeply applied, then the more the heart is liberated from its obstructions. There's a very helpful discourse that I often like to quote. It's called The Lump of Foam. It's where the Buddha's talking about the way of, say, developing that insight into the insubstantial and uncertain, empty quality of the mind and the body, the physical world, the mental world. And he uses a set of images. He starts off with he and a group of monastics by the river, and they see this lump of foam floating on the surface of the river, and the Buddha takes that as an example. He says, you know, that lump of foam, that froth on the surface, floating on the surface of the river, all rupa, all form, material form, is just like that. It has a shape, but there's no solidity there. There's nothing solid. There's no real substance there. So rupa is like a lump of foam on the water. And then Vedana, feeling, says when the raindrops fall down, like today was a rainy day, so when rain falls onto a puddle or a pond, like onto the pond at Maikuti. It says as a raindrop hits the surface of the water, it makes for a brief time, it makes a bubble as a very transient form of a bubble or round shape as the raindrop hits the surface of the water. So that's what Vedana is, just like a water bubble. It's there for a moment, it has a shape, and then it's gone. There's no solid permanent thing there. Feelings of comfort, feelings of discomfort, feelings of pleasure and pain, mental or physical. Sanya, perception, is like a mirage. So if you're out in the desert and in the hot weather, then the heat of the sun causes the distortions in the atmosphere, and so the light from far away gets formed into a mirage. You appear to see some buildings or some trees or some water that appears to be close by, but they're not really close. The mirage has got no substance, it's got no form, it's just a patterns of light, light forming into shapes that seem to have a solid presence, but there's no thing solid there. It's empty. And then sankhara, mental formations, emotions, moods, memories, ideas, plans, thoughts, that whole great array of my mind, my thoughts, my feelings, my memories. That is, he said, it's like the trunk of a banana tree, a plantain, that like a leek or an onion. It's just layers and layers and layers of leaves. There's no stick. There's no trunk. There's no solid wood that forms a heart. It has no heartwood. It's just leaves upon leaves upon leaves. And so that there's no core, there's no substance. So even in the world of our ideas, which we love so much and we think are so real, you know, my opinions, my thoughts, my emotions, you know, when we're happy or we're angry or we're resentful dull and confused, crazy, inspired, these are all just like the trunk of a banana plant, just layers and layers of form, but with no substance. There's no real core, nothing solid at the center. No real thing there. And then consciousness, vijnana, that discriminative consciousness, the act of cognizing something itself. There's that feeling of discernment, distinguishing one thing from another, cognizing any object. It's like a conjuring trick, like a trick by a performer pretending to make an elephant vanish, or pulling a rabbit out of their hat, or conjuring images and voices in the air. Now, these are all ways of helping us to look at the array of material form of our body and the world around us, our feelings, perceptions, mental formations, ideas and thoughts, and the act of cognition itself, and to learn to not see these in personal terms, but just to recognize these are or patterns of organic change that really have no owner. They're not who and what we are. They're just patterns of nature arising, taking shape, and dissolving. That's what they are. There's no thing really there. And dukkha, suffering, a sense of disharmony and alienation, insecurity, unhappiness, all comes from taking them to be real, taking them to be solid, taking them to be who and what we are, or me in here and the world out there. So the more that those five khandhas, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, the more they can be seen as uncertain, empty, transient, then that is the way, the framework that all experience is given, then the more that every attachment internally to our body, our personality, or externally to the rights and wrongs of society and the social forms that we experience around us, the more those can be seen as empty. As that, how could that be really me? How could that be really mine? How could that be anything that's solid and true and substantial and real? How could it? Like the sound of the alarm, it's just a sound. We say, oh, that's a fire alarm. That means this. But through the application of that insight, moment by moment, and then seeing the results of that, seeing that the effect of applying that insight into uncertainty, emptiness, to really know that, to see that directly, and the effect upon the heart when that's recognized as, oh, it's just a sound, it's just hearing. And I say fire, I say good, I say bad. Look at that. It's all down to what the mind makes out of it. Something that we call good, and we get excited and pleased by it. And then a little while later, then the same thing, the same perception can be, oh, that's bad, that's awful, I don't want that. It's all what the mind adds to it. One of the areas of attachment that is, as I said, some things are easy to see as impermanent and transient, as empty. You know, the sound of my voice, a feeling in your leg, a memory of a conversation. You can see it arising and passing away, and that we can maybe let go of it and not make anything of it very easily. But there are certain areas of experience that it really does feel like me and mine. And particularly things like being criticized. If someone gets upset with you and says, you've really done that wrong, that's really awful, that's bad, you know, how dare you, who do you think you are? Someone attacks us, at least you know, verbally, or criticizes us, blames us, and says, you shouldn't have done that, that's really awful, that's dreadful. Who do you think you are? You call yourself a monk? And this kind of area is a prime territory for self-view. When we're criticized or blamed, or someone is upset with us, then it can really rouse those feelings of I and me and mine in a stronger way than almost anything else. When you're being misunderstood or misrepresented, criticized and blamed, then we can feel, well, that's not fair, or who do you think you are? And it wasn't that way, and let me explain. Though it triggers those self-defensive habits and so it's good to consider and to look at those kind of reactions. Say, well, what form do those take? How do I feel? How are those felt? And seeing, maybe this is a completely inappropriate example for you, that you're quite happy to be criticized, and that doesn't even that doesn't even make a ripple. But other things that have a much more significance to you, that you don't mind being criticized, but if somebody cooks the food in a way that you don't like, then you get really upset. Or somebody makes too much noise in the next room, or whatever it might be. So we have to look and see at our own lives. But this area, for most people, where you're being, blamed or criticized or misrepresented, it's a really good territory to explore. It's a good area to look at, because we need to learn where those habits of self-view get born, where they get launched from, and how they work, because the point of practicing the Dhamma is to realize the Dhamma, and that realization can only come about through the breakthrough of self, breaking through self-view. So it's helpful to explore, where does it get born? What shape does it take? How does it arise? And how does it get believed in? When we see those feelings arising, say if you're being criticized, and when I say being misunderstood or misrepresented, that's one dimension of it, is where people are saying things about you that are incorrect, and they really are being unfair, and so then the self-justifying mind jumps in and says, well, that's not fair, that it didn't happen that way, or that's not right. So that's one dimension of it. But sometimes people criticize you because you actually have done something that's worthy of criticism. So it's quite reasonable for them to be upset. So I'd say there's at least two different aspects to it, whether you're being wrongly criticized or rightly criticized. But either way, we need to look at that feeling in the heart that doesn't want to accept that, or doesn't want to deal with that, pushes that away. And the feeling of self-view, the feeling of I and me and mine that arises on account of that. So one helpful approach is just to, first of all, to name that that's what's going on, that just to recognize, oh, this is the feeling of me being criticized. This is what being blamed is like. It's exactly like this. Ow! I don't like. There's this feeling of dislike. I don't like this. I want to get away from this. That's what's happening. This is a painful mental state, and something in me is waiting for it to be over. Wants to get away from it. That's what this is. It's this feeling, and it has this effect. And as I often say, the simpler that we keep it, just to name what's being experienced, to not add any kind of commentary or to be telling a story about it or planning what to do with it, but just to receive it as clearly and simply as possible, and also to feel it in the body. Where do you feel that sense of being blamed or feeling of resentment or intimidation in you? How does that sit in the body? What's that feeling like? And the more the mind can be fully aware just of that feeling, then the more it can know, well, this is just a pattern of nature, just like if the wind blows from the northwest and the trees bend towards the southeast. That's what they do. The wind is coming from that direction, and so the trees will bend accordingly. So similarly, if that something gets said that is arousing to do with criticism and arouses that feeling of hurt, that those words are heard, this is the feeling that arises, just like the tree bending in the wind. It's just a natural consequence. It's not personal. That process of not taking it personally is part of it. Also, just to take a step back from the experience, like say, when we live in a little place like Amaravati, and we have some of you might think it's a big place, okay, big, small, whatever, but a contained place, then we can get very, very focused on the particular dynamics of the other people that we live with, the other Anagarikas or the nuns or the Samaniras, the lay community, the bhikkhus, Anagarikas. We get very, involved in the micro politics of our little sphere of activity, my group and the dynamics that are here and who's senior to who and who gets on with who and who doesn't get on with who and how is everybody doing. And this person's very impressive, and that one's very depressive, and we can get hyper-focused on each other and say, just forget that there's a world outside the walls of the monastery, or forget that the particular thing that we're taken up with, like that person was critical of me, or that they said something bad about me. And so the whole world can shrink to that one feeling that somebody, you've heard somebody say something nasty to you, or that they had said to somebody else something bad about you. And the whole of the rest of the world can vanish. Everything else is gone. But that person, you know, how could he do that? Or, as I was saying earlier, just, you know, he took my sponge. You know, he's always doing that. Yeah. And so it's important for us to see how the world can shrink. And that can become the most important thing in the universe. The whole area of our concern just comes down to that, carrying that one feeling around of, how could she say that? That's not fair. I'm going to get my own back. It shouldn't be this way. So it's always helpful. And when I lived here back in the 80s and the early 90s, I used to live on the South Corridor in the Monks Vihara, with these big windows looking out onto the hedge and the trees. And I used to, it was a certain time, there was a lot of turbulence in the community. A lot of the senior monks had disrobed and left. And it was a lot of anxiety and tension in the air, and a lot of criticism and fear and so on. And I used to look out at the squirrels jumping through the branches of the trees. And the squirrels have their own politics here. They have a very their own structured social order, and I'm sure they've got terers and terries and long-term lay residents and, you know, anagarika squirrels and samanera squirrels and those who'd like to become anagarika squirrels and squirrels who want to leave and go to a different hedge, and squirrels who are trying to get into this particular hedge but they haven't got the qualifications yet. They haven't really been accepted. They're still a foreigner. And I've watched the squirrels, and I think they haven't got a clue about all these difficulties in the Sangha, and all these what's going to happen about all these monks who are leaving, and is it all falling apart, or is it going to, what's it? And so I found that was really helpful. The squirrels have got their own dynamics and their own particular concerns, jumping about through the branches, chasing after each other, running away from each other. And how we share this space, we cross over, we share this space together. They haven't got a clue about the Amaravati Sangha politics, just as we don't really have a clue about the squirrel politics. And and so the mind says, well, that's just squirrels. I mean, they don't really matter. I mean, it's just them. But then it also helps you to take a step back and go, well, so, I mean, Ajahn Ananda doesn't have a big bushy tail, but, you know, what makes him substantially different from any squirrel, really? I mean, nothing personal, Ajahn. What's the difference, really? You know, I focus on a particular comment I've heard that somebody has said, praising or criticizing or complaining or being upset. And so that becomes fundamentally significant and real, but it's only become real because of what my mind has added to it. What makes it more real than the squirrel politics, jumping through the branches of the hedge and the ash trees and the oaks? Why is the human politics more real than the squirrels? Or the voles, you know, or the worms, you know. Let alone the pigeons and the jackdaws, magpies. So to take a step back and to look at the world as we experience it is so helpful. It makes such a big difference. To see things, what the impression that we have of the world is just a tiny fragment of the way things are, and to remember, oh yeah, this is just a sort of a working hypothesis. This is just a sketched up version of what's actually happening. This is just my particular impression. That's all. This is not the whole story. How could it be the whole story? It's just one little patch is just one little ripple in our fishbowl, in our one little fishbowl. That's all. It's no big thing, no special thing. And then when the view shifts in that way, then we have a very different perspective. The heart immediately, at least I find, the heart relaxes and goes, oh, it's just a ripple. It's just a ripple, not even a ripple in a fish pond. It's a ripple in a fish bowl, just a little, like a little ripple in a glass of water. Well, that's all. It's nothing more to it than what the mind adds. And so then, you're not, and that's not dismissing that there are things that need to be said or done or things to be attended to in terms of our relations with each other, but it keeps it all in perspective. It keeps things in view and helps us to not over-inflate and get that sort of hyper-focused on one particular obsession or fear or aversion. And then letting go in that way and learning to develop non-attachment, then how it might seem that there you're trying to not feel or not care or just sort of dismiss everything. Oh, it's just a ripple in a fishbowl. It doesn't really matter. I don't have to do anything. I don't care what they think. It's not a matter of dismissing people's perceptions. But you know, maybe if they're complaining or they're upset, there is something that needs to be done or said or some way you need to change your conduct. But those changes don't come about based on fear or aversion or obsession or or attachment, but rather they come about through a wise appreciation of the situation. So we apply the standards of the Kalama Sutta. Okay, so does something need to be done here? What's going on here? Does something need to be said? What will bring benefit here? What will be of? It's not a big thing. It's just a little ripple in the fishbowl. But even though that's the case, is there something here that would be of benefit? Benefit to myself or benefit to others? What would help here? Anything? What would be harmful? What would be destructive to myself or destructive to others? And so we use those simple standards to measure, okay? Well, that's going to be, there's an impulse to act in that way, but if that's acted on, then there's going to be pain here and pain there, so let's leave that one. But if something else is said or there's some a kind word or a friendly act or asking for forgiveness, then that'll bring benefit here, benefit there. Okay, let's try that and follow that way. So that then we are able to both have a broader perspective and to not get take things personally, to just see things in their true perspective, their true light. But we're also not divorcing ourselves or abdicating, stepping down from responsivity. But the responses that we make to the people that we live with and the space that we share are based on what's going to be of benefit, what's going to be helpful, and what's going to not create more discord, more harm. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.